Thank you very much to all the speakers. I hope you found those stimulating presentations. So I now want to open it up to questions from you all.
My first question is, under the Equalities Act at the moment, there's no consideration for social or economic status of individuals. So there's no obligation on local state authorities to consider the social or economic status of individuals. If that's the case, then how can we ensure food security, access of the right to adequate food to local communities that are deprived? What's the obligation on the state to consider deprived individuals? And following that point, you mentioned that food banks aren't the way forward for persons who are suffering from food poverty. If that's the case, what is the way forward? Is it better education of the public, raising awareness? Is it government action? And why do you think it's food banks that are not the way forward? Thank you.
Okay, you're absolutely correct. Those are really central questions. And in 1 minute, I can't do justice to the complexity of that issue. So let me come back to just two, and that's part of what the ongoing research at the moment. I want to repeat what Ben said. This isn't us knowing everything and you firing questions. This is the start of a process of ongoing research. So please do write down and please do stay in touch. And I don't know whether this is going to be said at the end. It's on the board thing in front of you. We've got another meeting in a fortnight over at MOAC, which is in Coventry House, thank you, where we're going to formalise a steering group to carry this on forward. There are plenty of us already working in these areas, and what we're looking for is to ensure that we're picking up all the people on the campus who want to be involved, and not just on the campus. I know there are people off from other places too who are here and want to be involved. So, and this isn't at all a kind of, you know, clever academics answering a difficult question. This is saying those are two real, or one, but within it, two really key issues. I'm very pleased that you put them. I think the business about governments and state responsibilities for implementing a right to food is a really difficult one to work out in practice. And I don't know whether you're from the law department since you, or have legal training since you pick up on the nub of it. But certainly, for instance, the UK government has signed the UN Declaration of the Rights of Economic and Social Rights, and within that there is a very clear commitment to a right to food. And Olivier de Schutter, the UN Special Rapporteur on Right to Food, who I mentioned earlier, he has produced a really important paper about a year ago challenging many governments. Now, people usually think of this as a Global South problem. I mean, you know, Ben gave some very good examples of people who you could argue their rights are being overridden, that's by corporations, the problem there of what's the role of the state in reining in corporations or encouraging corporations to take over the role of the state in providing education and housing and all the rest of it. And actually the sugar industry is one where there's been a very long problem in that in many countries, as you may know. But it isn't just a problem in the Global South. There are plenty of people in Britain who cannot afford to feed themselves and their families decently. In fact, many of the people who really struggle are people who don't have children, because for the last 20, 30 years we've had a social policy which has been partially focused on reducing child poverty, but it has ignored the needs of older adults who are unemployed, and there's really quite an issue there about how people in those sort of households, or either employed or on a minimum wage, can feed themselves decently. There have been many studies which have shown you cannot eat enough, cannot purchase enough food at normal supermarket prices, and supermarkets by and large are on average the lowest prices, so this isn't, I'm not talking, I don't want to name supermarkets, I'm not talking posh end, I'm talking pretty minimal supermarket prices. You cannot meet your nutritional needs on the minimum wage. This has been done, tried in many different ways, can't be done. And that means that in Britain, for instance, and this isn't just an issue for Britain, but it, nevertheless, we are here at the moment, and we have the problem too. We have enshrined within our legal, within our social system, something which prevents people from securing sufficient food to lead a healthy life. And part of the right to food is, as I, it's very, the right to food is very like the definition of food security, in fact, that people should have access to sufficient, affordable food that meets their cultural and social nutritional needs, etc. And that they should do that in dignified ways. And again, there has been a great deal of both legal and social grassroots evidence that receiving your food through charitable handouts contravenes your right to food. A huge amount of work has been done on this in Canada. There's a growing movement on that in Britain. There is also a growing food banks movement in Britain. We have a very small food bank system compared with many parts of mainland Europe and with the United States and Canada. But be not under any illusions that... I'm not against charity, by the way. If you want to talk about that afterwards, I'm very happy to tell you, how I do that sort of thing. But I don't think that is the way to meet citizens' needs and rights for sufficient appropriate food, that we rely on other citizens through a formal mechanism, which in Britain at the moment is covertly and increasingly overtly working hand in hand with the Department of Work and Pensions, to ensure that when people, for instance, have become unemployed and there's a gap before their benefits kick in, that they are sent to the nearest food bank and given charitable handouts, which have come from the food industry, of surplus and excess, from the food sector. And of course, the food industry is able then to claim that as part of their corporate social responsibility. They don't have to pay so much landfill tax. Win-win all round, apparently, except perhaps for people who don't have the means to feed their children. Of course, people, if you ask them, do you want there not to be a food bank, will say, God, no, excuse me, I don't mean to insult anybody, offend anybody. Of course, we wouldn't have survived if there hadn't been somewhere to go and get food. So I think it's a really thorny issue to get a handle on. And if you ask me what is the way forward, actually, I think it's paying people a living wage. I don't know whether the University of Warwick pays a living wage to everybody. I'm sure it pays the minimum wage. Maybe it pays above the minimum wage. But in the City of London, for example, one of the things that the current Mayor of London has done is to promote the living wage, which is based on a minimum income standard, calculated very systematically and scientifically, as well as consensual statements about what it is that people need. So you're not just saying... people have to eat a sort of least cost diet and always get their clothes from second-hand shops or something like that. It's a very systematic way of calculating. You can look, it's the University of Loughborough's leads it, funded by the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. If you put minimum income standards into Google, it'll come up straight away. And those have formed the basis of a living wage, which, as I say, is used certainly in many parts of the City of London and by a number of employers around the country. And that doesn't address other issues about whether people can get to the right shops, whether people know how to cook and use food and all of those things. But if they haven't got enough money, all of that's irrelevant. So you've got to get the money right first.
Thank you, Liz. Any more questions?
Yeah, thank you. I suppose you'd expect the university chaplain to perhaps ask an ethical question. It feels like... everything that was said today involved our view on ethics, actually. Whether it's issues around self-interest of the global north and multinationals, whether it's whether we get our the global south economies to grow all our least eco-friendly crops for us so that we don't have... the ethical dilemma in our own backyard. The question of whether cheap food is actually good food and whether actually we're, by looking purely at getting cheap food, we're actually causing long-term problems in terms of human fertility and other sort of negative aspects of very cheap food, often food full of... antibiotics that have been pumped into animals in order to keep them more productive and alive. So lots of, it seems to be, very ethical questions. I suppose that also brings us right down to the brass tacks of questions like, does Warwick Food and Drink use fairly traded food? I remember trying to find some fairly traded tea bags, and the University of Warwick wasn't the obvious place to find them. And lastly, before I became chaplain in this great institution, I was in a very poor housing estate in Bradford. And just to give you an idea, I used to take a funeral every two or three a month. And the average age of people in that very poor community was about 55. So it isn't just a global south issue. It's people dying in places like Canley, which are only a mile from here, because they haven't had as good a diet as we have only a mile away in the University of Warwick. Thank you.
I thought it was a really good question, set of comments, actually. For me, the big issue that I think is facing people who are interested in ethics is how do you make people care about the producers of food and the relation that people have to food. The turnout here suggests that there is a groundswell, I think, of people who care about food, and you see this in lots of different ways. The farmers market is a common example that's cited at the local level and at the global level, which is arguably a lot more difficult because of the social space between someone making the food and then someone buying the food. But that can be kind of brought closer through things like fair trade, which tell you a little bit about the person who's making the product, the conditions in which they're doing under it, and how your behaviour directly affects their livelihood. I just think that's so important. And that, just chatting to other people who've interested in food, is the great thing about food. You know, it connects people. And once you begin to realise how people are interconnected and affect one another through their behaviours, you know, that opens up so many possibilities about how you can change the world. So, you know, I think there's a lot of possibilities through food, and I would never see that as take a pessimistic view on the probably terrible problems that we've outlaid for you today. You know, I think there's actually a lot of hope about making change, you know. So that would be my two pence here.
In the UK, most people begin life in a hospital, attend school, and end life in a hospital. Over the last decade, 15 years, public-private initiatives have built state hospitals, state schools, and then the state rents them back. A lot of these hospitals and schools have not been built with kitchens. What does that say about the state and the right to food when, in the example of hospitals, they're expected to produce meals, three meals a day per patient on less than £4 a day?
I'm not going to defend the state. Right? I'm not going to defend the state on those initiatives. I think you've raised a very critical issue there. And that's one of the things, as I said, that when I was flagging up the questions that I'm interested in and working on, that I didn't have time to spell it out with the strictures behind me. But that was beautifully put. And I would add in some people along the way work in the armed forces, one way and another too. Many of whom, unfortunately, end up on the streets subsequently, and there's another issue about whose job it is. And prisons. Well, I'm trying not to link those two. Yes, but you're absolutely correct. The state has a number of institutions. Let me just give one example of, because I think in a way what you're encapsulating a little bit about what Ben was just saying too, about the disconnection that people have often just assumed that food's another kind of systematic product of a capitalist society and you just go and buy it. You don't think about how it's produced and so on. I think a lot of people are changing that view, and I absolutely support what Ben said about the importance of building that groundswell. And I wasn't just being polite when I said at the beginning, I thought how terrific it was to see so many people here tonight. I know from teaching myself at Warwick for 10 years that when I began teaching on the politics of food and nutrition, most of the people I was teaching knew very little about what I was talking about. And there were hardly any textbooks. That is not true this year. There are some of the students I'm teaching this year sitting in the room, and they're ahead of me. They already know a lot of this stuff. People are already beginning to understand more. You all have friends and family, and you have to talk to them. We all eat. And actually eating together is a good way of starting conversations about how food has come and so on. And I think if we have one of the contributions we can make from Warwick in this global program is, for my Penneth, is putting the ethical issues up there and asking these hard questions and finding ways through them. And let me just give one example, which hasn't directly come from the university, but it has built out of work that I and others here have done. Excuse me. I mentioned that I'd done a little bit of work about the reconnection stuff. And as you may know, in Britain, as elsewhere, there are a number of grassroots initiatives coming. They're not just about producing food in different ways, though many of them are. They're also about enabling this reconnection to go on. In Britain, more of the work has gone on with young people and schools. So, for instance, there's been a big lottery-funded initiative called Making Local Food Work. And, I mean, there are lots of ways one can pick holes in it. I've slightly done so myself sometimes. But I've also visited lots of the projects that have got funded under that. And I know, for instance, a bit about the work that's been going on in schools, the Food for Life initiative funded by the Soil Association. It's easy to sort of poke fun at these things or to say, oh, they're very small scale and all the rest of it. Many things are very small scale to start with. And sometimes they work better when they start they spread by word of mouth and by having an inspiring teacher who goes to another school and says, oh, this school has now started growing food and has got the children involved in growing school and food, so their science lessons include some of the stuff they do in the school gardens, and now what they're growing in the school garden is appearing in the cafe, and some children learning how to cook it, and so on and so on. All of this sort of groundswell up actually is beginning in the right place and is engaging more and more young people in all of this. And I think a lot of those initiatives, and also there are community-based initiatives like that too, all sorts of community-growing initiatives that are going on, and not just talking about production. The point about that, I mean, you're not going to meet your whole food security needs by what you grow in a window box or allotment, but what it does is to sensitise you to a lot of the issues and to make you aware that if you can eat good food in one place, you can then start asking questions about why are my children not eating good food in another place? Why, when I go to hospital or my mother goes to hospital, is the food so dismal? And it's by people asking questions and pushing and finding the loopholes and finding the room for manoeuvre in the system. That's how we get the change. So, a bit of a long-winded answer.
Thank you for organising this event. First of all, it's great to be here and see all these people. I wanted to ask Ben Richardson, do you know of any example, a positive example of sugar production? I don't know anything about the two examples you gave. I know a little bit about Senegal and DR Congo, and the two examples show monoculture, unemployment, problems with chemicals, and so forth. Is organic fair trade doing anything for this? Is there any positive example? How would it work? I know sugar production is very, there's constraints with time and infrastructure. So is there any positive example? And also I wanted to ask, in general, we talk about not having enough money and time to cook, and we want food to be easy and ready-made. Is this an illusion? Is money the only trigger that will make rich countries that are the less affected by climate change, is money the only way to make them stop eating unhealthy and unsustainable food? I don't think it is, by the way.
Thanks for the question. They are few and far between, I think, in general. Sugar as an industry has got a problem connecting benefit and poor people because it's so capital intensive and large scale. It's almost an innate difficulty, really. But in Swaziland, there were a few schemes the small farmers have flashed up the picture of. They had to take on a lot of debt to buy the irrigation to enable them to water the crops, and feed into the sugar industry, you know, but they wanted to do it because they get a decent revenue by local terms. And there's been a lot of studies on that to show if you can bring water to very dry areas and if you can give people a steady financial return, that is of huge, huge benefit, you know. And I have some great sort of moments when I could see a little homestead, you know, and on one side would be literally a stick and mud building. This would be a sugarcane farmer who got into the industry 5-10 years ago. And then you could see a new building, which was made of brick, and it had a corrugated iron roof, and it had a toilet outside rather than basically, well, you get the image of what they used to do before. But a real tangible, you know, on the ground improvement. And what I would really like to see is for the companies who are most influential in the sugarcane supply chain, which is the retailers, the food manufacturers, which is your Coca-Colas, your Nestle's, Cadbury Kraft, these kind of people, they've got the clout to send messages down the supply chain saying consumers want to buy sugar that has benefited people on the ground. Fair trade's difficult in sugar because they only work with small farmer cooperatives and there's just not that many of them. But certainly buying fair trade helps. But for me, it's the big players who too easily avoid responsibility for the sourcing of their products who really need to step up their game. So any lobbying efforts at them, I always endorse. Yeah.
David Skinner, I'm a city councillor. I represent Canley. I'm also a director of Whitefriars Housing. Perhaps I could have a word with the chaplain afterwards. I'm also a retired Foreign Service officer. I'm well aware of many of these problems. I've seen a lot of people die, but I've not yet heard one word this evening about corruption and violence in the host governments.
Hi, thanks for that. I'm glad you reminded me, actually, because I've just written a paper on Swaziland, and where I point the fingers is the buyers of sugar and also the host government. They're terrible, really. Partly that's an issue of limitation in terms of just the resources. When I've been to poor countries, generally the government literally, in some cases, hasn't had a presence in the rural areas. You know, there's no kind of extension offices there from the state. There's no hospitals, et cetera, et cetera. But also I've found that states generally do what powerful companies tell them to do in the sugarcane industry, and that often involves allowing migrants, like in the Dominican Republic, into the country, channeling them in, not providing them with papers and so on to allow them to claim citizenship and all the rights and benefits that brings. And there's been a very hand-in-glove relationship, especially in a lot of the old sugar-producing colonies. So that's a real issue for me. I think it's very important that you raised it.
I just add in, I agree, it's very important issues. It's not just in the global south that governments turn a blind eye to migrants coming in. If you look at the meat industry in the United States, in the southern parts of the United States, it's largely built on the backs of the migrant illegal, or what is regarded as illegal migrant workers from Mexico, as well as legal migrant workers. It's a complicated story, I'm simplifying it. But when it suits the government, they're very happy to have that problem. And I'm not about to set out the details here because this is a relatively public meeting. But if you look at what goes on in the fruit and vegetable industry in Britain, you will find the way in which government in Britain over the last 5 or 10 years has passed the buck down to the farmer to check the migrant status of the workers who've come to work, rather than, despite the efforts of the gangmasters licensing authority, rather than really getting to grips with it. It's not just the Global South that does this, I agree. This is not, again, a Warwick output, but I mentioned that I'm a member of the an NGO called the Food Ethics Council. I'm a member of the council and one of the trustees, and I'm going to do a plug. We publish a quarterly journal, which you can download, and there's more copies there that you can have a look at. And in the report Food Justice, which I had in my hand a little while ago, and I've obviously left on a table somewhere, Food Justice, which was the image I showed on the slide, you probably couldn't see it from the back. If you look at the Food Ethics Council website, again, just go straight into Google, you'll find it. The Food Justice report, which came out last year, July 2010, looked at fair play, fair say, and fair shares. And fair play was about wages within the corporate sector and about the very issues that we've just been talking about, the exploitation of migrant labour. And, you know, government's turning a blind eye. We all turn a blind eye.
Hey, sorry, another social question. Science isn't my forte. It seems to me in a way that, like, a spectre seems to be haunting all the answers, and I'm going to say it, the C word, capitalism. And I just want to ask, can an economic system based on the accumulation of profit produce, like, food equality and security? An example of this being food speculation, which is obviously one of the worst examples of how capitalism can distort the food system.
That's always the tough question, I think, for me. I think, personally, I'm more of a reformist, and I'm more interested in what's sort of imminently feasible and plausible. So, for better or worse, capitalism is the broader system in which most food is going to be produced, although there are lots of interesting circuits of exchange that operate outside capitalism within the broader food system. I just think of the way, you know, you share food amongst your family and friends, or you might grow in small plots or whatever. That's not capitalist to me. And I think that's very interesting about food, that it offers those alternative spheres of economic activity. The food speculation point that you mentioned is a really interesting one, and there's been a lot of politics about the extent to which that's caused the high prices that we mentioned earlier. Some people point the finger at biofuels, some people point the finger at food speculation, meat consumption in China, etc., etc., and it's helpful for some people and for the story, you know, to have a bogeyman to point the finger at. But my concern is that really just misses the point about it doesn't matter how much food has been over the last 20, 30, 40 years. We've consistently had 700-900 million people, and now recently just over 1 billion people in, you know, chronic undernourishment. And so I think really it's less about the broad nature of capitalism, which has changed dramatically during those 30, 40 years, and more about thinking about poor people and how they are served and how they can be given the prospects to buy food, you know, earn a wage and have land and water to grow it themselves. That, for me, is where I focus my attention.
I just add in, a couple of weeks ago, we had a visiting fellow here under the Institute of Advanced Studies program, Jeff Tanzi, and one of the things that he says in print and in person is that much of the world food system, which is capitalist, runs on rules that are not rules of nature, they're rules of people. And rules can be changed. They have been changed. They have been increasingly, I agree with what Ben says, but it's also the case that over the last 10, 20 years, some would argue, those rules have changed for the benefit of rich countries and rich corporations, particularly transnational corporations, and maybe rich individuals too, I don't know. And that those rules can be changed. They don't have to stay like that. That's particularly, I guess, true of the commodity speculation story. For a very long time, agricultural commodities were outside the WTO rules, and then they were brought in about 10 years ago. And for a long time, 10, 12 years ago, this is putting it very crudely, for a long time it wasn't worth speculating in food so much. The futures market wasn't so interested in food because there was more money to be made in other markets, like subprime mortgages. And some argue it was the collapse of that meant people suddenly thought, actually, we can make money on food commodities. And as Ben says, it's a very contentious area and one where people feel very strongly indeed. And If you want to read more about this, World War, War on Want has very good documentation. War on Want and WWF and ActionAid and ChristianAid have all brought out recent reports and are campaigning about that issue. I really would love to hear some questions that are not about entirely directed to this end of the table.
I think my question is actually more directed at the other side of the table, and it has to do with fish and ensuring biodiversity of the seas at the same time and as you're trying to balance it out with ensuring food security. And obviously we can see how fish is used in many, as you say, many aspects of the food chain. So how can you actually regulate and how can you overcome overfishing and ensure biodiversity at the same time?
Oh yes, I certainly agree with the agree with the question. I'm not sure I actually know the answer to the regulation bit, but yeah, I mean it certainly is about restricting fishing in some way, and if you don't restrict fishing, then it can eventually collapse, as happened in Newfoundland, sort of 20 or so years ago, it's extremely difficult. I mean, yes, you can see from, you two know more about it than me, but, you know, in terms of fishing around, you know, in the waters around the UK, I think it's very difficult to actually, you know, regulate what gets taken. So has anybody in the audience got a...
So there's a few things I think I know, which is a bit dangerous, isn't it? I think there are areas in the UK where fishing has been stopped for various species. So one of the ones that comes to mind is scallops, I think. And they've discovered that, in fact, the recolonisation is much faster than they thought it was going to be. Areas where they stopped fishing cod, the numbers have increased again faster than they thought. So I suppose there's hope. And it's about developing a strategy where we can fish but then leave areas to replenish. And I think one of the other big things that's coming through is this issue about, you can only fish for some species or they have to be bigger than a certain size. And so these incredibly huge nets, which are just bringing in everything. And the fishermen were chucking 2/3 of it back dead into the sea. And I understand that's changing as well. So I think there is hope. Just to cast a problem onto all of that, the problem I see with farmed fishing, which is again a monoculture, is that we do have diseases going into the oceans, which are probably able to vamp themselves up and become quite damaging because of the fact that we've got these monocultures very close together. So that's not being addressed, but we need to think about those too.
I wanted to ask the panel whether they thought there was a case for arguing that water security is actually a more pressing problem than food security, or vice versa, and why.
The trouble with both water and food security is that they are very spatially different issues. Food security in this country is very different from food security in, say, sub-Saharan Africa. Water security in this country is, again, very different to different parts of the globe. Water is possibly the single most precious resource we've got. What I often say in my lectures is you can survive without food for... 40 days, I think, is the record. You can survive without water for maybe 2 or 3. So, in my opinion, you're right in that water is a more important issue than food. But, of course, they are so closely interlinked that you can't draw them apart. But, yes, I do agree with your statement. Okay, how much water is used in food production? What we tend to use is a metric called the volumetric water footprint. When its most basic term is the complete volume of water, or all the water that's used in the production and the process of a product. And the example that I tend to use is a litre of milk. And to say that it actually takes 1,000 litres of water to produce a single litre of milk. So all the water used to grow the grass that the cows live on, all the water used to produce the cereal that the cows require, drinking water, processing water. So the whole life cycle chain of water goes into a product. The way that we can change diets, so a kilogram of beef takes approximately 15,500 litres of water to produce. And that's a huge volume of water. Yet a kilogram of wheat takes about 500 kilograms of water. So if you're thinking of changing diets to improve food security, to improve the volume of food produced per water used, cereal crops, not livestock products, make far more efficient use of water. And that is true for all meat products and all cereal products. And the higher Western-type diets require a lot more water than a vegetarian-type diet.
Thank you. Science question, I think. Rosemary and Laurie, you both touched on the impact that driving higher yields has in terms of stress on land and animals. Is there enough research going on into ways of increasing yield without producing that stress? And if there isn't, why do you think there isn't?
It's a very good question. I think from the animal side, I would say that we've tended to work in monodisciplines. So if we look at the biggest improvements, in inverted commas, in yields, if we're looking at egg production, meat production, milk production, would all be through genetics. And it's incredibly easy to improve yield through genetics. You just make things bigger. So bigger cows produce more milk per day. Bigger end weight pigs grow faster, can be killed at a younger age and produce more meat. I don't know if you know, but the end weight of a sow these days is near to 400 kilos. So you're thinking about a cow with short legs. A cow that these days weighs 1,000 kilos, whereas she maybe weighed 600 kilos 25 years ago. So it's very easy. It's linear. You talk to the geneticists, and I have asked this question. Can a cow ever reach a maximum yield? As in, she has to eat a certain amount to produce the milk. My personal opinion is she has to lie down for a certain amount of time to digest the grass or the grain that she's eaten to go on producing the milk. The geneticists say it's down to someone else's discipline to produce an environment that doesn't stress that cow, and then we can carry on increasing milk supply. And I think we have to get together. And I don't think just across the monodisciplines of the natural sciences, but I think across the monodisciplines of the social sciences, to look at that issue of sustainability. And it then gets very, very difficult. There isn't an easy answer. But some of the work I've done, I've looked at lame dairy cows. And the first thing you discover is that the cows that are most likely to become lame are the cows producing the highest yields. So they are stressed. And at the moment, their environments are running for an average cow in the herd. But the high elite cows, if you like, are under huge amounts of stress. And that leads to disease. That leads to poor milk production. So, in fact, they're not yielding their best anyway. So we're already, I would say, at a stage where we're facing that issue. So that's the animal side.
So with the crop side, I guess the answer would be that probably not enough research is being done. But again, I guess genetics possibly provides some of the answer. And I'm not just talking about genetic modification, but conventional genetics, in that it is probably possible through looking through, you know, wild relatives and crops and things like that, to identify traits that could be bred into crops, which will mean that they can be grown with fewer artificial inputs. So if you can identify sources of pest or disease resistance, then you can cut out the inputs, so you might be able to maintain yield and without sort of stressing the environment so much. Likewise, people are now looking for traits of better use of nutrients and water use efficiency as well. So there's scope there. One of the other areas is looking for ways of controlling pests and diseases biologically. My view is that now there isn't enough research going on in that area. So there's a lot of theory, but actually whilst biological control works pretty well in glass houses now, which are contained environments where you can control the conditions and you know the control agents are confined. In the field systems, we still really don't know in most circumstances how to make those methods of pest and disease control work. And in the UK, that you know the funding for that area of research has declined dramatically. And we're fighting hard at the moment to actually, you know, retain the expertise and the facilities to do that sort of stuff.
I'm allowed to cross the table. I thought that was a really interesting key question, actually, and the answers too. I guess I just wanted to add in, there are some circumstances, both within Britain or Europe more generally, and globally, where actually maybe it isn't always just increased yield that's the critical issue, but it's the security of yield, sorry to use that word, it's knowing that you will get some yield, whether it's crops or animals, in increasingly unpredictable environments, I mean physical environments. Whether you're born and bred in Britain or just here for a short time, if you've even only been here for a few months, you will know the weather is a bit unpredictable. It's slightly cooler today, but for the last week it's been quite warm for November. And I still have tomatoes in the garden, which is bizarre. And the newspapers are full of, you know, this crop, that crop is doing odd things. And that's all kind of interesting and funny, but it's actually very serious for the whole sort of chain of insects and plants of interdependence. And I think it's with climate change, it's the unpredictability of rain and temperatures and the interplay between those two that are making it really difficult for farmers here and elsewhere and rearers and so on. So I guess it's sad that there isn't the right funding to do that kind of work that both Laura and Rosemary were talking about. But it's even sadder that there isn't money to look at this sort of, well, not enough money, to look at this kind of risky stuff, you know, risky environments. How do we ensure that people have something which may not give the maximum yield or would only give maximum yield under wonderful conditions, which, you know, are pretty unrealistic, but which give sufficient to enable people to live. Heavens, we learned this through the Green Revolution. You don't just want clever plants that grow lots of rice or lots of maize or wheat under perfect conditions. You want plants that will go on producing good yields, good income for small farmers. And most of the world's producers are small farmers or small rearers. So.
Yeah, I just wanted to say something sort of following Liz about crops being resilient. And one thing that we have done, both with animals and plants in farming systems, is go for homogeneity. So, we have animals that are sort of very similar. And, most of our crops that we grow are, you know, virtually genetically identical within a field. And so to a certain extent, by doing that, by getting rid of diversity, I mean, not only the biodiversity, but also the diversity in our crops, then, you know, we've increased the risk. And I guess in the third world, they quite often, you know, use systems like intercropping where they are growing a whole range of crops on the basis that if one fails, another will succeed. And also, research that I've done with colleagues has shown that diverse cropping systems can also have benefits in terms of pest control and things like that. So there is, you know, a lot going for diversity, but at the moment our farming systems are, you know, gone the opposite way.
I'm conscious of time. I'll allow one more quick question.
Hi. I was thinking then about the thing that's not been touched upon is, I'm not sure if it's included in here, is food safety. And if this drive to produce for the lowest cost exacerbates the problem with safety, as we need traceability to from the animal to the finished product, from the crop to the finished article in Supermarket Shelf. Is there any research on adding safety measures into add to traceability so before we have another catastrophe, like E. coli or whatever? Anyway.
On the issue of traceability, I think we have one of the best traceable systems in the world. As a result of BSE, every single cow that's born has to have an ear tag within a month of birth, and every time they're moved, they have a little passport. It's all done on paper still at the moment, and that goes with them to the next place and so on right through to slaughter. That system's now being introduced for pigs being moved in batches. It was all done on paper before, but it's now being done electronically. And so we will know where all the pigs have been. So the end result already is that supermarkets can trace nearly all their meat products back to the farm of origin. So we do quite well on traceability. Of course, it doesn't necessarily mean our food is safe, because that's a whole process that goes alongside it. But of course, if people are accountable, then the safety aspect will come in. I mean, I know there's masses and masses of regulations on safety, but I don't know. It's probably best to hand over to someone else to talk about the safety issue.
Yes. Well, I mean, just to reiterate what Laura said, that I think in the UK we have the best sort of safety systems probably in the world, and I guess that is driven by the UK supermarkets. Absolutely, yes. So fruit and vegetables, they again can be traced back to supplier. But from the supermarkets, I'm not sure that would be the same, with stuff from the wholesale market, but definitely, yeah, they can trace it right back. And we have, we have a very rigorous system with lots of checks and balances.
I think I'm going to have to bring this evening's proceedings to a close. Before I do, I think you'll all agree we've got, first of all, to thank the four experts who have provided their time.